ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Ann Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr.
I don't think that, seriously speaking, really, that anybody in his right mind would want to be a writer. But you do discover that you are one. And then, you know, you haven't got any choice. Either you live that life or you won't live any.
James Baldwin is still read. Though his reputation fell off a cliff while he was still alive, his work now, 40 years after his death, has a grip on the public imagination. He's in print, he sells steadily. My local bookshop in Sydney has the lot, Giovanni's Room, Another Country, The Fire Next Time. Three biographies of the man have appeared in the last 10 years. The third is The Shape and Colour of a House Brick. But let me tell you, Baldwin, A Love Story by Nicholas Boggs is superb. A rich account of a strange and contradictory genius. Baldwin had a fair idea of how strange he was. His career, he once remarked, was a way to make use of his strangeness. I'm joined now by Nicholas Boggs, author of the new biography. Nicholas, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nicholas, why has his reputation sprung back? I mean, it was really in the doldrums by the time he died.
Well, that was 1987, and he fell out of favor for reasons that we can go into. But in the interim, something interesting happened. In the 90s, in the university, he was still kind of and sort of in artistic circles by artists like Isaac Julian, the great filmmaker. His legacy was being kept alive, mostly by Black queer artists. And then in the early 2000s, we saw the rise of Black Lives Matters in the United States. And we saw the film I Am Not Your Negro by Rallo Peck. We also then saw Barry Jenkins, an adaptation of If Beale Street Could Talk. So Baldwin's words re-entered a kind of social media age where, in fact, you know, he's so magnetic on screen and all those incredible appearances he made on television that he seems almost tailor-made for our moment, in fact.
I wonder if there's something of this as well. There he was preaching the need to fix the appalling racial situation in the United States. In the 1970s, there was a lot of optimism around. It was all going to work out. Everything was going to be fine. We didn't need this preacher hammering away at us about all of this. But it hasn't turned out to be all that fine.
No, it hasn't. In the 60s, in fact, Baldwin was much more hopeful. I mean, he was very, very moved by the March on Washington. He was very, very moved by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I mean, both of them in different ways represented what he thought of as a hopeful future for Black Americans in particular, but America in general. But by the end of the 60s, he was incredibly frustrated with the lack of improved conditions. And he was living, in fact, most of his time in Istanbul at that point. So by the time the 70s rolled around that you just described, he had already sort of decided, in fact, that he was no longer writing for what Toni Morrison called the white gaze. So we see his work both in nonfiction and especially in fiction in the 70s and beyond, looking inward. So even though he was living in Istanbul in the south of France, he was looking at the Black community that raised him in Harlem, in novels like If Beale Street Could Talk, and then later Just Above My Head. So Baldwin, a radical shift occurred for him after the murders of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
Let's go back to the very beginning. He was born poor.
Yes.
Black, gay, and less discussed, effeminate. And as he discovered, he was born a bastard. And he called himself a scared little boy from Harlem. How does a scared little boy from Harlem climb out of all of those pits?
Well, I love the way you just described it, because it's very similar to a question that he was asked later in his life about, you know, an interviewer asked him, you grew up black, poor, and gay, you know, homosexual in Harlem. How was that? And he said, I hit the jackpot, because you just couldn't get it more outrageous. And you had all this material to work with. So for Baldwin, you know, he was able to take what was a quote unquote disadvantaged background, but because from the very beginning, he was a brilliant. He'd read the Bible back and forth many times by the time he was 4 years old. He was reading Harriet Beecher Stowe when he was five. He read his way through libraries. He was reading A Tale of Two Cities by the time he was 10. So he had this preternatural, you know, talent just in general. But he also grew up, you know, yes, he grew up without some advantages, but he also had all these teachers, black and white, in Harlem who recognized his brilliance.
Yes.
Supported him. So he had a charmed life in some ways, actually.
He had a capacity, and I'd love to examine this, a capacity to attract mentors, helpers, teachers. And it wasn't just the teachers he had at school, but this kept going, didn't it?
It did. I mean, he you know, after Bill Miller's one teacher, Kaunte Cullen, the important African-American Harlem Renaissance poet, these were his teachers when he was in school. But outside of school, he was introduced to Buford Delaney, now one of the most known, as one of the most important, not just African-American painters, but modernist American painters. He was this sort of village figure. Baldwin was introduced to him by a friend at school when he was 16. And this was the man who introduced him to blues, to jazz, how to see the world as an artist, took him backstage at Carnegie Hall to meet Marian Anderson, taught him, in Baldwin's own words, that a black man could be an artist. A few years later, he moves to Greenwich Village and a friend knows Richard Wright, sends him out to meet Richard Wright, who tries to help him with his career. And they actually forge this a complex relationship that continues when they're in France. But yes, there was an almost an uncanny thing happening with Baldwin, where he would, just when he needed it, somebody would reach out a hand. But I think it was Zadie Smith who recently wrote about this, about Baldwin and sort of about herself, saying that, yes, it's one thing for somebody to reach a hand out to you, but Baldwin reached back, right? And that's the other part. There's a certain kind of bravery and ambition that he had. In his junior high school yearbook, he wrote, his saying that he chose was, fame is the spur, but ouch. Baldwin was ambitious from the beginning, and fame was something that he was after.
And these people who helped him really early on, he stuck with for life, didn't he? I mean, his life was full of people. Armies marched and partied through his life. But he looked after both Delaney. He looked after Bill Miller, Bill being a woman. And he wrote to them, and they were part of his life all the way.
Absolutely. Bill Miller, I mean, what an incredible story. This is the white school teacher who came to his Harlem school and ended up, because they were, you know, so busy at the school, took him under her wing and took him out to see an all-black cast of Macbeth, went him saw to movies to see Betty Davis on screen, a major moment for Baldwin when he realized that Betty Davis's eyes were beautiful and therefore his mother's were and so were his. And he corresponded with her. They fell out of touch, but then when he got thrown up in the civil rights movement, she reconnected with him. Buford Delaney, I mean, one of the things that I was so interested in this book, you know, was how these relationships, these love relationships, whether they were platonic or erotic, pedagogical or otherwise, were relationships that sustained Baldwin throughout his life. And Buford Delaney became, you know, as Baldwin called him, his spiritual father. This was the man that followed Baldwin to Paris. They forged a relationship that lasted decades. Baldwin took him to Istanbul, took him to the south of France. And these kinds of kinship structures abroad were the ones that actually made Baldwin's political work and his literary work possible and had the longevity that it did.
He also called Delaney the old Negro who helped me grow up. Isn't that beautiful? Now, Nicholas, early on as a child, Baldwin was a preacher. His father was a preacher. Well, his stepfather was a preacher. And this little kid got up and, on your account, mesmerized black congregations preaching the word of God. Did he ever stop preaching for his entire existence? The rhetoric, the power, the need to preach.
Well, of course, Baldwin himself said that he left the church, but the church never left him. You know, he stopped being a preacher in part because he was struggling with his sexuality, in part because he wanted to become a writer. Remember, books were outlawed in his home. And so this was a major, major struggle for him in his teenage years. He also believed that the church was hypocritical. He didn't want to be preaching a hypocritical gospel. However, it never left his language. His first novel, Goat Held on the Mountain, is basically about his experience leaving the church, and it's infused with those sermonic cadences. But his essays are even more infused. The Fire Next Time, all of them. These are the product of a preacher, no doubt.
And you say at various points in the biography that he is listening to gospel music as he writes.
Gospel music, even more so probably the blues and jazz. I mean, when he went to Switzerland with his the love of his life, Lucian Happersberger, where he finished writing his first novel, Goat Held on the Mountain, he brought two records with him in his portable record player, and those were two Bessie Smith records.
I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog on my roll. I can stand a bit of loving. Oh, so bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad.
He listened to music, you know, all the time. And in fact, he would often say that he wasn't trying to write, so he wasn't trying to kind of follow other writers, but he was actually trying to approximate the jazz and blues in his writing.
Who were the musicians that meant most to him?
Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, later Miles Davis, who was a dear friend of his, Nina Simone, who became a very good friend of his. Josephine Baker meant a lot to him. Lena Horne, actually. I mean, these are people, Maya Angelou, people who were singers as well as, you know, figures, you know, figures, personal attachments and figures in his life. They were all very, very important. Bats Waller. I mean, the list goes on and on. It all came through Buford when he was in Greenwich Village.
A couple of years after the end of the war, this kid from Harlem, well, Greenwich Village by that time, but this kid goes to Paris. Why Paris?
Well, you know, Baldwin himself said it could have been anywhere. I mean, he said it could have been England, although he was glad that it was France. He just had to get away. You have to remember what he was experiencing at this time. You know, he's this brilliant young man, but, you know, as in his own words, the Negro papers, you know, only want him to write about Negro subjects. The white papers only want him to be a paper boy. And he has watched his father die early from tuberculosis, and he watched his sort of best friend and would-be lover, Eugene Worth, jumped from the George Washington Bridge to his death. He knows that Buford has been attacked in the village, you know, sort of racist and homophobic ways. So he felt that he was next. He felt that if he did not leave the U.S., he was going to die. And so he applied for a fellowship. He got it. And he gave most of the money away to his family because, again, he was the eldest of nine children. He was a breadwinner. He felt very guilty for leaving, but he sort of understood that he needed to save himself. And so off he went to France, in part because it had this history. Richard Wright had already gone there. It had this history of Black expatriates, or musicians mostly, but also writers, finding some measure of artistic freedom in a very, very constrictive time in American history.
Richard Wright, explain. Some of the listeners may well have forgotten about Richard Wright.
So Richard Wright, when Baldwin was growing up, was, as Baldwin put it, the most famous Negro writer in the world. I mean, he had written Native Son, which was a massive, massive bestseller, the first African-American to be chosen to Book of the Month Club. People don't know what that is now, but that was a very big deal in the U.S. back then. And this was a writer who took Baldwin under his wing, but before Baldwin got completely fed up with the racism and moved over to France. And when Baldwin got there, the first thing that happened was he was brought to a restaurant. I mean, actually, Sartre de Beauvoir had just left the table, and Baldwin was brought to Richard Wright, who helped him find a place to stay in the beginning. They later had a falling out, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way Baldwin would sort of later represent that he arrived penniless in Paris, penniless and friendless. And in fact, he was met at the station and taken to the fanciest cafe in town. He's living partly on a shoestring, but partly, at the height of fashion.
I think that's true for a lot of artists and writers, actually. Even today, I think they can be going to really fancy parties and be invited to nice places, but then they go back to their, you know, rent-controlled apartments or their group houses far out in Brooklyn. I don't think that's unusual. I mean, he was not misrepresenting the level of kind of impoverishment that he was experiencing. He was staying at this hotel where, you know, basically you had, there was, everyone shared a bathroom where you had to stand on like on two holes or something. I mean, it was very, at the same time, he luxuriated in this experience of freedom, of being around these other bohemian artists for the first time, hanging out at Café de Flore. You know, he loved those early years in Paris, despite many difficult things that happened, including being thrown into prison. But this was a big, big moment in his kind of, you know, young adulthood and coming into being.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. And I'm talking to Nicholas Boggs, who is the author of the new biography of James Baldwin, Baldwin, A Love Story. Nicholas, there's a pattern set in Paris that continues for the rest of his life. There's chaos, absolute chaos, drinking, sex, partying, and there's the discipline of writing. And those two impulses seem to be at war for his entire existence, the chaos and the discipline.
At war or in cahoots? I mean, he would stay up all night drinking with friends, later often reading his writing to them, which was very, very inspiring to him, actually. Then everybody else would go to bed and he would stay up until the birds were singing, typing away or writing on his pad of paper. This was the cycle that he was in, particularly in those early years. And I think it got set in his system and it continued throughout his life. Of course, we could also say that there was a lot of chaos happening elsewhere around him, whether it was back home in Harlem when he was growing up or during the civil rights movement, you know, the dangers that he was experiencing when he went south or others did. So chaos was sort of always an ambient part of his life. And in a sense, what he was doing as an artist, as a writer, was finding a way to create art out of the chaos, to create art out of the suffering and the heartbreak. This was sort of second nature to him. It became part of his artistic DNA.
And it was in Paris that he met Lucien Hapersberger, who you mentioned before. Tell us about Lucien and this pattern that began with Lucien and continued for the rest of his life, the pattern of falling in love with men who were essentially not gay.
Right. Well, I could see because the pattern may probably have started even earlier with Eugene Wirth, you know, the person I mentioned before who jumped from the George Washington Bridge, a kind of somewhat unrequited love, but when he died, he thought maybe Baldwin felt that maybe he had sent the wrong message to Eugene, and this had sort of contributed to his suicide. It's important that to understand that you know, these men, Lucien in particular, that Baldwin was drawn to, were drawn to Baldwin. This was not they had sexual and romantic feelings for and relationships with Baldwin. So it wasn't this sort of one-way traffic, can we say. However, I do think that Baldwin was drawn to these men who stood outside of all of social categories. I mean, Lucien was a hedonist. He was an artist. He was a free thinker. He was totally entranced by Baldwin and did fall in love with Baldwin, but he was also interested in women. It's true. Baldwin fell for these men in part because I think this was a structure that was familiar to him from the way that he grew up with his estrangement from his stepfather, you know, this sort of drawn to him and rejected by him. So this was a structure that he was used to. But I think in an even more important way, the impossible love that these men represented was also a kind of impossible love that Baldwin felt for America. He kept leaving America, going back, breaking up, creating works of art out of that breakup. And these weren't just erotic situations. With Richard Wright, it was the same phenomenon. He was his mentor. They broke up. And what happens? Baldwin is able to write his first novel. So this kind of, drama, you could say, or conflict, was something that certainly fed Baldwin's art in all kinds of registers, actually.
But at some point, after he's had about four relationships with men like Lucien, don't you have to acknowledge that the pain these relationships brought, the estrangement, the fluctuations of them, was something he actually sought?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. I think it's something that unconsciously, as I said, I think he understood, you know, on some level, you know, I come to a moment in the book where I'm asking Yoran Kazakh, his last great love, precisely this question. You know, why, you know, Baldwin wanted a long-term relationship. It was a really revelation for me, this moment. I was talking to him in Montmartre in his studio, and he was only 2 years away from dying, actually, although I didn't know it at the time. And I said, well, apparently Baldwin wanted a long-term domestic relationship with you. And what was going on with you? And he actually started laughing at me. And I was very taken aback. I didn't understand it. But the reason he was laughing, he's saying Jimmy might have said that's what he wanted. But in fact, he was not capable of that himself. He had all kinds of adventures with other guys. And he was not, you know, his life would not have accommodated that kind of domestic relationship. In the end, there's a way that Baldwin got exactly what he, whether he wanted it or not, exactly what he needed, which was these deep, intense, creatively productive, tumultuous relationships that became large kinship relationships that were actually larger than a romantic partnership. These men became his blood brothers, as he called them. They became his family. They became, you know, they returned to his bedside. These were not relationships that ended and then were over. They were transformed into something else. And all of these different transformations were part of what sustained him throughout his life, up till the end when Lucian returns to his bedside.
Mm. A very beautiful scene. His first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, appeared in 1953. What was the reception for that novel?
Go Tell the Mountain was well received. It was blurred by Marianne Moore. This was a novel he'd actually been working on, you know, since that, before that moment that he met Richard Wright in Greenwich Village. It was an enormous relief to Baldwin to get it published at all. And, you know, it's a wonderful novel. It really has stood the test of time. People talk about it and write about it. And the reception at the time was very, very good. Good enough that Knopf, which is, of course, was and is an incredible publisher, wanted Baldwin to just continue writing the same thing, right? And Baldwin, the iconoclast that he was, who wouldn't put in any box, you know, refused to do so. But it did well enough as a first novel that his career, you know, they felt he had a very promising career. They just wanted it to go in a different direction than it ultimately did.
So Knopf turned down the next book.
Giovanni's Rome, yes.
I mean, that's right. They wouldn't publish this sort of homosexual-tinged novel. And I wonder whether they regretted that for the rest of their existence.
That I don't know, but it was a remarkable moment. You know, when he, when he got the letter that said, we're doing this as a favor to you, not to ruin your career. But it later came out that in fact they found the homosexual themes repugnant. And in fact, you know, this is again a sign of the historical significance of what Baldwin did. I mean, this is way pre Stonewall, right? This is a black man writing a gay novel featuring white characters, and the biggest publisher in the world is saying we won't publish it. And he says, these are his words in an interview. He says, fuck you. And he takes it and he brings it over to England. He finds Michael Joseph decides to publish it, and ultimately gets published in the States. And it's a finalist, and people forget this, it's a finalist for the National Book Award. And it becomes a very, you know, now, of course, it's a classic novel, but it gets really good reviews. I mean, some of the reviews are kind of condescending about the homosexual parts, which is the whole thing, really. But they could not deny the beautiful writing. And to this day, and college students, they love this novel. People are dying to see this novel turned into a film, et cetera, et cetera. So it's now a classic. That never would have happened if Baldwin hadn't had the gumption to do what he did.
I reread it a couple of months ago. It's a heartbreakingly beautiful book. So James Baldwin, by the middle of the 1950s, has an established literary reputation. But this black kid from Harlem had never been to the South. What happened to him when he went South for the first time in his life at the age of about 33?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because that's actually a remarkable fact, right? His family was from the South. He'd never been. When he wrote "Go Tell It on the Mountain," he imagined all the South really in such incredible ways, but he'd never been. And he was actually afraid of the South. In a way, he was also afraid of Africa. He was afraid of his past, sort of distant and way distant. In 1957, he went there on a magazine assignment. And at this point, you have to remember, Baldwin had just sort of made it as an artist. And this is his dream. He didn't see himself as a political writer necessarily. Remember, that's what he critiqued about Richard Wright. And yet here he was hearing about the desegregation of schools, hearing there was this young preacher, Martin Luther King. He's sent down south and he is absolutely transformed by the experience, not just, you know, getting on the segregated and also desegregated buses, not going into, you know, restaurants where he's told to go through the colored entrance, et cetera, but in a more positive way. It's when he goes and meets Martin Luther King, and especially when he goes back to the Black Church that he has disavowed, that he has stepped away from. He steps in, he sees Martin Luther King's speech, he's completely roused by it and the rhetoric of love. He's roused by the congregation, and he sees, most importantly, it's not that he rediscovers God, but what he discovers is that the Black Church is a key site of community and, perhaps most importantly, a key site of political mobilization. And Baldwin realizes that people like Sterling Brown had been telling him this, that he was a skilled writer and he had a duty to be, as Baldwin put it, a messenger.
But what was his message? He wasn't calling for this piece of legislation or that piece of legislation or, you know, this reform or that reform. It was something much deeper, wasn't it?
He was calling on the country to take a moral position, right, on desegregation, to say, you know, that segregation is morally wrong, which nobody would say up to that point.
One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, that is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. What is crucial here is that unless we can manage to establish some kind of dialogue between those people whom I pretend has paid for the American dream and those other people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble.
The legislation will follow once that clear point is articulated by the leader of, you know, the country and perhaps the free world. But he was also, you know, very influenced by King in this. He was saying, you know, his message was one about love. I mean, as he would later put it, in Fire Next Time, only love will throw open the gates, that, you know, black and white Americans must come together metaphorically like lovers in order to make freedom real. So his message was philosophical, sermonic, and abstract. But as I guess we'll get to with RFK, he also did have very clear designs on the kinds of legislation that he wanted to sort of push the politicians to push through.
Yeah, that was unfair of me. That really unfair of me. But was it as early as this that he was saying there is no white American who can escape their role in what has happened to black Americans, that the white liberals cannot excuse themselves because their feelings towards black Americans are generous and civilized?
He was already writing that in essays like The Preservation of Innocence and especially Stranger in the Village. You know, ironically or not, his really kind of, I'm not going to say come to Jesus moment, but the moment that he had a profound realization about like this category of whiteness was when he had been in the early 50s in that Swiss chalet writing Go Tell It in the Mountain, where he was the only white black person for miles, right, in that village. And being the only black man there and seeing how the villagers sort of treated him, not like meanly, but with this kind of lack of knowledge, made him really think about this whole idea of innocence and white innocence. And this is where he, you know, this is a theme that he would talk about again and again and again for the rest of his career. But this is when he realized, as he put it, that this idea of American innocence, this myth that there was no sort of past of sort of in violence towards indigenous or the enslavement, the kidnapping and enslavement of Africans, that this idea that white people were not guilty or did not want to confront and really interrogate that past, this constituted the crime, that the innocence, as he put it, constitutes the crime. So these ideas were already there, but it wasn't until the 60s, really, that he had the platform to kind of reach a larger audience with these kinds of notions.
I put a spell on you.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Nicholas Boggs, author of Baldwin, A Love Story, this new and superb biography of James Baldwin.
Because you're mine.
Nicholas, tell us the story of the Kennedy confrontation. It's so wonderful. And it had an outcome that mattered.
It did. This is an example of just how strategic Baldwin was in some ways. This is a story that has many different characters, been told many different ways. And so it's hard to parse, like, you know, everybody has their different version of it, of course. But basically what happened is that, you know, after Baldwin landed on the cover of Time magazine, he got RFK's attention. And after the events in Birmingham, et cetera, they wanted to avoid, the powers that be wanted to avoid, as they put it, a similar situation in the North. So Baldwin was brought down to meet with RFK in D.C. And then RFK said, I want you to put together, you know, let's have a meeting in New York. This was supposed to be a secret meeting, a private meeting. But what Baldwin did that morning, he was finishing his play, Blues for Mr. Charlie, which would end up on Broadway. And so he was being interviewed by Louis Funke of the Drama Desk, in fact, in New York. And at the end of that interview, Baldwin slipped in, oh, and by the way, I'm about to go see RFK. And oh, by the way, Harry Belafonte is coming and Lena Horne is coming. And so the New York Times reporter says, oh my goodness, this is a story. Can I tell my colleagues? And of course he does. And so it ends up becoming a big story. And Baldwin, I think, mentioned those celebrities to kind of get the attention of the Times, but it was sort of a Trojan horse, because who he ended up bringing was Jerome Smith, this young freedom fighter. And he brought his brother, and he brought a whole bunch of, you know, Kenneth Clark, a whole bunch of other people. They had to bring out footstools to seat everybody. Lorraine Hansberry, importantly, was there with him. Lena Horne did come, and Harry Belafonte. But what they did is they got the freedom fighter to speak. And this really rattled RFK and his attorney general, Burke Marshall, because this was somebody who, you know, had really been on the ground fighting, you know, for and nonviolently, right? And but he was saying, basically warning them, and Hansberry echoed this, you have to be careful. Like, we come here in peace, but, you know, you kept this, African Americans are fed up. And if you're not careful, and this is sort of what Baldwin would later say, you know, in the fire next time, you know, this things could get, you know, really, really bad. And this was not what RFK wanted to hear at all. And Lorraine Hansberry ended up storming out of the meeting. There are all kinds of different versions of what happened. And he was very, very unhappy. Baldwin then went straight to the radio show and gave what is now a very famous speech there. And he was exhausted. But what happened is, in fact, Baldwin had been saying in that meeting, you must take a moral position. And it wasn't long after that that the president did, in fact, take a moral position and did, in fact, move towards, you know, the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act. So it was a publicity stunt. That's what they called it. And in a sense, they were right. But it was one that in some ways was very effective.
I was shocked to discover in the book the reason that Baldwin didn't speak at the great meeting in Washington, where Martin Luther King delivered the I Have a Dream speech. Why was he not on the platform?
So this is another great example of Baldwin's strategic acumen, and also kind of not lack of an ego, because he had one, but his ability not to let his ego get in the way of a larger purpose. So he had actually been in Paris just a couple of days before the March on Washington, and there had been a smaller march there where he'd written a speech, and they walked down the Seine with African Americans supporting the March on Washington, and he thought he was going to read that speech. And he came back, and Bayard Rustin had been sort of sidelined somewhat, who was a Black gay activist who really organized the whole march. And Baldwin was even more sidelined. They did not want him to speak. Instead, you know, and this is not widely known, but there's a video of it. they had Burt Lancaster, the actor, the huge actor at the time, the white actor, reading Baldwin's speech.
We recognize that it is not only in America that the battle for freedom and dignity of peoples is being waged. The struggle toward freedom on the part of the previously subjugated.
Without saying it was Baldwin's speech. So it was a very strange moment, as you can imagine if you see the video. But Baldwin took this in stride, in fact, because he saw, that there was and he was very moved by the whole day, by King's speech, by Mahalia Jackson singing. But Malcolm X is the one, some people say that he was excluded because of his homosexuality. And I think there is definitely much truth to that claim. But as ever with Baldwin, it's more complicated than one factor. What Malcolm X said is that they didn't want him on stage there because they couldn't control what he was going to say. And you have to remember the March on Washington, they didn't allow women to speak there. They weren't going to allow homosexuals to speak. But also Baldwin's speech that he was going to read was broader than the U.S. He, remember, was coming from France. It was actually about a call for Black liberation globally. So that's another reason why, he wasn't allowed.
How did Burt Lancaster go delivering James Baldwin?
Well, I have the link in the back of my book, and you can find it. It's very bizarre. It sort of, just like papers are flying around, and the crowd seems very confused. And I don't think it went well. I do not think it went well.
It does bring us to the point of examining Baldwin's public acknowledgement or lack of acknowledgement of his own sexuality. I mean, almost to the end of his days, he rejected the notion that he was homosexual, didn't he?
Well, no. I mean, early in his life, actually, he would write in his journal, "I am homosexual," and tell his
friends. But that's the journal.
No, he told his friends, but Baldwin actually rejected all categories. Okay. He rejected Black, white. He said, there's no such thing. You're only white if you think I'm Black. He rejected male, female by the end of his career. Now that doesn't mean that there wasn't a particular valence around the sexuality stuff. I mean, he felt for him, these are his words, that for him, the question of color, right. And the question of racial civil rights came before sexuality for him. It was the more pressing. It was the most pressing matter of that time. This would shift later in his career. And it's important when we're looking at Baldwin's life not to trap him in one moment, because he shifted his mind about a lot of things. He moved much further to the left around civil rights and other issues. He became way more interested in gender, right, than he did earlier in his life. And he, by the end of his life, he was having very frank conversations with the Village Voice and elsewhere about his same-sex relationships. But he also was saying the word gay wouldn't have meant anything to my lovers. And this was true. His lovers were not gay, So he was being very truthful in that sense. But he was also writing in his nonfiction, his late nonfiction and fiction, but particularly his nonfiction. He was going back in very different ways and re-examining his early sexual experiences when in Greenwich Village and Harlem and elsewhere. And he was being very, very introspective and honest about it. So the things that he might have said earlier in his life that I think were different by later in his life, but he did reject all identity categories.
That's a position you can take, I suppose, but there is something uneasy, is there not, in a writer who wrote so beautifully about homosexual experience, not just frankly saying, yep, I'm one too. There's something evasive here. And yes, the four or five men he yearned to have intimate domestic relationships with were not in a traditional sense gay, but he was picking up men all the time.
Sure, for example, when he wrote Giovanni's Room, people wanted to call it a homosexual novel. He says, it's not a book about homosexuality. It's a book about what happens when you're afraid to love. Which is a much bigger.
Which is a wonderful line. It's beautiful.
He was never in any closet. He was never hiding from anyone. But he refused to let the dominant culture define him, to say, you are this. You are a Black writer. You are a gay writer. He understood that these categories were the problem. They were not the solution, right? These were oppressive categories. Now, he was a very proud Black man. He loved Black culture and Black music and Black people. It wasn't that he was rejecting Blackness in that way. What he was rejecting was these methods of categorization. He simply did not did not believe in them, and he did not live his life by them. His friendships were with Black people, with white people, with men, with women. You know, he was not, he was attracted to these men who, even though they may have been predominantly with women, they also did reject these categories. They were outsider artists. They were iconoclasts. This is what he was drawn to, because this is part of who he was as well.
Later in the book, the question of gender comes up, and the notion of his response to his own femininity. Was that something he found difficult to confront?
I think so. I mean, I think he grew up being called frog eyes, sissy, et cetera. And I think it was difficult. And you have to remember, then he rises to prominence as a Black writer at this very macho moment, right? Where,
yes,
you know, where he, and you, so you'll see him in some of these interviews saying, you know, I have to take care of my woman and my child. And that's, sometimes people think that that's, you know, he's being in the closet. No, he is being rhetorical. He is being symbolic. He also says, I hoe the cotton. You know, he didn't hoe the cotton himself. He understands that he is playing this symbolic role for Black America, and that he is this voice of history, right? In those moments. So there was a kind of imperative there in the 60s that I think was troubling for him to play this macho role. By the time the 70s came around, though, he really understood. He always did. He talked about the writing of novels as giving birth. He was very interested in sort of the female experience of giving birth. And he started carrying himself, you know, with these scarves that he would wrap around. He became, you know, very interested in his writing. If Beale Street could talk, he's writing from the first person perspective of a Black woman. He has Toni Morrison come over to the south of France and reads it to her to see if he's getting the voice right. His last play is a character based on him, who's an aging Black deep blues singer, diva woman. I mean, and he's writing essays like Freaks and the American Ideal of Manhood, where he says, we're all androgynous. Each contains the other, male and female, female and male. It may be inconvenient, but it's the truth. So I think he took something that was a source of shame and discomfort for him, and he turned it into art later in his life, which is something that he did, you know, throughout his career, in fact, in different ways.
There are several times in the book where you talk about these sessions where he picks up the manuscript of the novel he's working on and reads to a bunch of his friends for hours and hours, and the sun comes up and he's still reading. They must have been quite difficult events for the people sitting there.
Well, sometimes when I'm doing book events myself, I tell that story about Toni Morrison and how he takes her down to his office at, you know, midnight, his torture chamber, with popcorn, and reads his whole book to her. And then I tell people, okay, so sit back. And I show them my 700-page book, and they get very scared, and then they laugh because, you know, it's hard to really imagine that Baldwin did that, you know, because it would take hours. But he did it. He did it in Puerto Rico with his family. They read the whole play together, Blues for Mr. Charlie, in fact, different family members playing different roles. But Baldwin would also, Joran Kozak told me that, you know, Baldwin would read to him in front of a mirror, and how mesmerizing it was. He called him a shaman, you know, an actor. I mean, this was how Baldwin performed and worked through what was working in these novels. And Jessica B. Harris, the food historian, and she said she sat there through the whole novel.
The whole thing. But it pointed to, didn't it, to the voice in his work, that the voice was the voice of a man, not necessarily in a pulpit, but a man addressing, or a woman addressing, the audience. It was this is spoken stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, he wanted to be a playwright and a novelist. I mean, he was a playwright, very successful one in many ways. The On Man Corner was on Broadway. You know, Blues for Mr. Charlie was on Broadway. He directed Fortune in Man's Eyes, not his play, John Herbert's, in Istanbul, and a remarkable experience that he had there in the late 60s. He was a performer, and he wanted to be around performers. He was drawn to them. Maya Angelou, Nina Simone, Miles Davis, Bill Cosby, actually. I mean, he was drawn to, you know, and it's very rare. And that's partly why I think he was such a force to be reckoned with on television and radio. Most writers are very introverted. You know, they want to be out there typewriters. And he had that incredible ability to step sort of from behind, you know, the screen out into the world and with his magnetic eye and mesmerizing eyes. And that's part of what has made him like such an enduring icon.
And he was a devastating debater. And we have the films to show that. Tell us about the debate with Buckley.
So the debate with Buckley is really interesting. You know, he won the debate. It was a debate about the American dream and the American Negro. But it happened, what fascinates me about that debate is less the debate itself, although it is interesting, is how it has endured in his iconography.
Yes.
It's one of the things that I get asked about the most. And it's one of the things that interests me personally the least. And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, Baldwin, this was this transitional moment where Baldwin had been sort of writing in the New Yorker and writing for liberals in some ways. And he was in the 60s with the, you have to remember, just a month before this debate, he lost Lorraine Hansberry. She died very early of cancer. And just 3 days after it, he got the news that Malcolm X had been murdered. Now, I would argue that those two events, right? Now, Lorraine Hansberry was way more radical than him and sort of was pushing him. And obviously, Malcolm X was. Those two deaths are way more significant than the Buckley debate, but that's the one that we talk about more. And also that this was the kind of apotheosis of the white gaze, this moment, you know, that he was in a sea of these white Cambridge guys and this is something. And then after that, he turns in the 70s away from sort of writing for white liberals in the same way and really writing, you know, for Black Americans and about.
And you argue in the book that it was the death of Malcolm X that changed him.
Yeah, he says it himself. I mean, that was a major moment. Certainly, the killing of Martin Luther King was another big moment. This happened when Baldwin was in Hollywood, which is a whole other story that we could get into. These deaths also of his friend Medgar Evers, these deaths were devastating for him. And it's really important to remember because we forget this, like how dangerous this time was. I mean, the FBI was following him. There were death threats everywhere. He was afraid and legitimately that he was next. He wasn't spending half of his time or more in Istanbul and in the south of France just because he wanted to, you know, because he liked Turkish coffee. You know, he was truly in danger. I mean, he had the wiretaps to prove it.
Your way into his life is via a children's book, though to call it a children's book is to iron out some of its interesting ambiguities. Tell us about the discovery for you of that little book and how it brought you, the little book called Little Man, Little Man, and how it brought you to the business of writing the man's life.
Well, it is sort of little. It's 100 pages long, and it's a strange book because it's not a children's book. Baldwin called it a children's book for adults and an adult's book for children. And it's written in Black English. It tells a story of these kids in Harlem who are confronting police violence and mass media surveillance. And this is in the 70s. I mean, it was really ahead of its time. I discovered it when I was an undergrad at Yale taking a class on Baldwin. And I was actually, I was reading David Leeming's very important 1994 biography had just come out. And there was just a paragraph or two about this book and this obscure French artist who did the illustrations. And I sensed that there was a story there that maybe they were lovers. It was unclear. I went to see the book. It was really a fascinating book. And so I wrote like the second email of my life, 1996, to David Leeming saying, do you know anything about this obscure, about Yoran Kazak? He said, I never met him. A very nice email, but he said, I never met him. I don't know anybody still alive who met him. And I'm pretty sure he's dead. So the internet was, you know, just coming up then. So there was really no way to track him down. 2003, I'm in New York City. I decided to send out some emails to art historians in Paris saying, do you know anything about Yoran Kazak, this deceased French painter? Here's my phone number. A few weeks or months later, I get a phone call in my Brooklyn studio apartment. It's a raspy French accented voice calling from Paris saying, I'm Yoran Kazak. I'm alive. Come over here. I have many stories to tell you about Jimmy.
And he does. You were blessed as a biographer. You give frank acknowledgement, as you did a moment ago, of the first biography of Baldwin. But Baldwin was a letter writer. How many thousands of letters of Baldwin's have you read and used and interwoven into this text so that his voice is on every page?
As many as I possibly could. I mean, Baldwin was an incredible letter writer. The letters that he wrote to Mary Painter, this is a brilliant American economist that he met early in his Paris years, and he dedicated another country to her. This was the woman that he said, well, I realized when I couldn't marry Mary Painter, I could marry no woman. I mean, she was one of the great loves of his life. And he would write to her these extraordinary letters about his creative process. He would write to her from the South when he was having nervous breakdowns from reading KKK pamphlets and seeing burning crosses. I mean, it runs the full gamut of his emotions through breakups, through the highs of publication. These letters are extraordinary. But they're not just, you know, they're very self-conscious letters in a way, too, because he is rehearsing his ideas for his essays and his novels. So they offer incredible insights into his creative thinking, creative process. Also, his letters to Engin Jazar, the blood brother who he followed, you know, he calls him his blood brother. He fell in love with him and followed him to Turkey, and they became lifelong collaborators and friends. These letters are also incredible. So, yes, to be able to access these letters at the Schomburg and at the Beinecke is a biographer's dream.
But there are still letters out there.
There are still letters out there, yes. I think at least a decade, some of the letters are from to Lucian Happersberger, to Baldwin's mother, and to Buford Delaney, and some of Mary Painter's letters are sealed at the Schomburg. So there's still more to go into, but it's not just the letters. I mean, the archives at the Schomburg are so voluminous that even I have not been through all of them, because you can't take pictures of them. You have to handwrite, transcribe them.
Did Baldwin ever turn down a request for an interview?
I'm sure he must have.
But how many thousands of interviews did he do in his life?
He knew how to speak the truth.
Precisely, one of the things wrong with this country is this notion that IBM machines and Cadillacs prove something. People are always telling me how many Negroes bought Cadillacs last year. You know, and it terrifies me. You know, I always wonder, is this what you think the country is for? You know, and do you think this is really what I came here and suffered and died for? You know, a lousy Cadillac?
He was a truth teller, and it comes across in the videos we watch, but it also it comes through in the interviews. You just sense that somebody is speaking to you from the grave now with the truth about his time and our own.
If you ever feel you need to dig into more of these interviews, Nicholas, we have several in the ABC archives here of interviews. Interviews of James Baldwin on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. They're here. We've got them.
Oh, how fantastic. The BBC has a bunch too. I mean, yeah, that sounds terrific.
But you could never reopen the book and add more material. This is a finished work, isn't it?
It not only is a finished work, but I will never write another biography. I'm one and done. This is my first book, my first biography, and this is absolutely the best I can do, and I will never try another one again.
How many years did you spend on it?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I got the book contract in 2018, but I had been working on it for at least 10 years before that. And according to my eighth grade English teacher, who first introduced me to Baldwin, I forgot this, but she said it in eighth grade, so I was like 12 or 13. I actually came in a suit and gave a presentation on his life. So I've actually been working on this book for 40 years.
Maybe once is enough, but, you know, I've heard biographers say things like that. Relieved that, you know, after decades of work, they've finished the biography that has been consuming their lives. But, you know, 5 years down the track, another idea comes along. It could happen to you, Nicholas.
I'm going on the record and assuring you that I don't think I'll even ever write another footnote. I will write other books. They just will not be biographies.
I don't want to hold you to that. I have enjoyed Baldwin the Love Story so profoundly, I am not going to hold you to that. But I am going to thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Nicholas Boggs, who is the author of Baldwin, A Love Story, the new biography of James Baldwin, in bookshops now in Australia, in hardback. And soon, I would imagine, it will be here in paperback. And that's the show. On our next, the origin of some of the most beautiful music ever written, nocturnes, music of the night. And we're looking at sovereign citizens who don't believe the law, any law at all, applies to them. The movement started in the States. It's now here. An eccentric nuisance with an undertow of violence. They shoot police.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.